Today's show, we go deep on the future of college sports with a fifth grade explanation of the house case. Who's getting the biggest donations in the SEC? Coach Prime sets standards. K-State is exciting, and Pat is angry about horse names again.
Time now for the College Football Inquirer with Dan Wetzel.
These horse owners and their bad names drive Pat to drink.
Russ Dellinger.
Manhattan, Kansas playoff game in mid-December. Right.
And SI's Pat Forty.
Don't fly fish, but I sometimes do look fly when I fish.
Here's Pat, Russ, and Dan.
All right, welcome to the pod. And headlines this week with the NCAA could be close to settling one of its myriad lawsuits. This one called the House Case, House versus NCAA. And it's a doozy. It's a big one. It could create and establish the framework or perhaps the whole kit and caboodle of a new system of athlete compensation. I believe this would be the end of amateurism in college athletics. Now, there might be carve-outs for different divisions, different things going on. But this is the one that they keep building, sort of like O'Bannon versus NCAA, then Alston versus NCAA, now this one. Our Ross Dellinger, of course, is all over this, as he always is, head of the curve. Ross, explain to me, just hypothetically, like I'm a fifth grader, like I have the mental capacity of a fifth grader.
That's just normally how I explain things just to hypothetically. You, Dan. That's normally.
No, it sounds like we're on brand here. Yeah.
I said hypothetically, gentlemen, you know, please explain to me what the house case is in simple, plain terms and what the hell is going on here and why I should care.
Okay, little Dan. The house case is a lawsuit, antitrust lawsuit brought against the NCAA and the power conferences. And basically, it's seeking a couple of things. It's seeking, one, for the elimination of basically NCAA amateurism rules to allow schools to directly pay athletes. NIL became a thing in 2021. So 2017 through 2020, the maximum allowed 4 years is kind of under the laws what's allowed. So it's seeking damages from 4 years. Basically, to put it in plainer English for you, little Dan, it is seeking as much money as athletes would have, the amount of money athletes would have made on NIL for those 4 years. And the figure that they've come up with is over $1 billion, right? We don't really, the figure's still floating around a little bit. It's probably changing like a lot of this. We don't really know. So those are kind of like the two things. One, it's seeking to eliminate NIL, you know, NIL rules, a lot of the NCAA NIL rules, including direct school pay, and two, back damages. Okay, so how do we solve?
Hold on. Let me just set that up there, because let me just say this. I was an excellent student at Sparrow Elementary School. Excellent student. So I can follow right along here. So what they want is direct payment to the athletes. They want to get rid of what we have now, which is this clumsy hybrid. And as a way to put the gun to the head of these colleges and use, they are using the back payment of billions, many billions as the hammer, right? The stick to get the carrot. Is this, would this be an accurate summation as I would have done in the fifth grade there?
Yes. Yeah. It very much A plus work there.
Mrs. Smith would be so proud of me.
Yes. Excellent. Excellent.
I'm not sure
that boils it down pretty good. You know, it's seeking to eliminate these NIL rules that prevent schools from paying athletes NIL directly. And as the hammer, yeah, it's saying, oh, you also owe athletes for the previous 4 years before NIL was allowed. You owe them this X amount of money. How they got that figure, they did a bunch of, I believe, public records requests with schools for NIL deals and such. So they got that. That's been happening over the last 2 years. You know, I mean, this is, I think we talked about this case a lot this spring, right? It's the single most, I think I've said it multiple times, the single most impactful court case in probably modern history of college athletics, because we kind of all knew that a settlement would have been inevitably happen and that it would change the course of how we think of athlete compensation in college athletics. And it's kind of where we are.
Aren't they also seeking treble damages? Like, so this $1 billion could become $4 billion?
Which is why, obviously, settling instead of going to court. If you lose in court, damages are trebled, you know, which is go from one to $2 million to $4 to $6 million pretty quickly, maybe. So in order to avoid trebling, you'd settle the case, which, you know, we, again, kind of been an inevitable end. It all started, the negotiations over a settlement, all really, I think you might say, heated up back in probably February-ish. You guys remember the Big Ten and SEC announcing a joint advisory board. We reported then that the main the priority of the advisory board was to explore new models that could be used to settle the case. Because to settle the case, little Dan, it's also broken up into two pieces. One is the back pay you owe athletes for those 4 years. And the other is lifting those amateurism rules, right? And then having a new pay model of some sort, a revenue sharing model of some sort. So there's two sides to a settlement. And it's been marching slowly, right? Marching toward, negotiations have been marching onward probably since February. And, you know, ESPN's story, I think this week, I think the new news in ESPN's story was that we've kind of reached the next step in the negotiations, which is more of an agreement on details of a framework. Not a lot of them were in their story, but you found, I was able to get some of them in our Yahoo Sports kind of explainer story that posted a little more details on the settlement, what it would look like on the revenue sharing model, what it would look like. So we're kind of going on the next step, and that's what happened at a meeting last week in Dallas. Is the next step, and that next step is more formulated kind of framework around a settlement. But we're a long way from having this thing done. You know, there are two or three more steps down the line here, which is presenting settlement terms to each conference's board of presidents, and they must adopt them, right, in some kind of majority or supermajority. It kind of depends on the league. And then the NCAA as well has to do the same. The NCAA, Charlie Baker, has to bring it toward before his board of directors or board of governors or both for approval. And there is a timeline here, right? There is a deadline, as we reported yesterday. It's probably around 30 to 40 days. Most people are circling the end of May to have some agreement or to not have an agreement. And then the settlement is poof, taken. Maybe settlement terms are taken off the table or significantly changed.
Correct me if I'm wrong here, but what the estimations that I've seen, if these settlement terms are agreed upon, that the going forward, the annual carve out by schools to pay athletes would be 15 to 20 million. Isn't that been the kind of the estimate thrown out there?
You know, I think we talked about that a few weeks ago. We broke it down in the percentages and stuff like that. You know, that's been, you know, I could tell settlement talks got pretty serious in probably late March, early April, because there's feedback from administrators on numbers, actual numbers, which we had reported a few times, which were, as you mentioned, 15 to $20 million. And maybe, again, things continue to change, right? So that number probably could change. I don't think it's going to go lower. So I think that it is probably at this point at least $20 million. Now, that doesn't mean that schools are required to share revenue with athletes of $20 million. You know, and this is a per school number, 15 to 20 per school. But it means that schools can share as much up to that, right? It's kind of like a a salary cap, you might say. And so it all this, all the settlement does is just kind of lift the rules on amateurism and allow schools to pay, and then maybe in sets this kind of sharing cap. Let's break down the settlement terms. And that's obviously the biggest one, right, is the money. Around $20 million is kind of a cap. Schools would be able to reach that. And at that point, you know, they'll be cut off. They can't pay share anymore, but they could also share 2 million or 4 million or 10 million. So they don't have to reach the cap. So one is the money is obviously a big important thing here. Two is the legal protection. How long does the settlement last? This one's as many as 10 years, is what I've been understood. It's around 10 years. Now that doesn't protect the NCAA and colleges on everything, but it probably does offer them some kind of protection from further lawsuits, specifically from this class. It's a class settlement from this class of a group of athletes. So there's the 10 years, there's the money, and then there's the consolidation of other cases, which is really important because there are other cases that Jeffrey Kessler, the lead attorney of the House case, we talked to him a couple weeks ago. I know we talked last week on the pod about it. He's also bringing forth two other antitrust cases, the Hubbard case and the Carter case. Hubbard case seeks more back pay, and the Carter case seeks more elimination of rules, basically. So it's basically the same, and they're consolidating them. Those are kind of like the three main probably elements of a settlement. But, you know, and we can get to this a little later, but not everybody wants to settle. And that's going to be an interesting argument in these presidential boards.
If not everyone wants to settle, but the people that are going to end up running this thing want to settle?
I don't necessarily think so. No.
Does Greg Sankey want to settle?
Well, I don't know. He hasn't said anything. You know him. He evades many of those questions. But it doesn't matter. He works for the presidents.
Yeah, he works for the presidents, but they tend to do what these guys tell him.
Yeah, they tend to take their they tend to take their recommendations or suggestions.
All right.
Right?
The 20 Absolutely. Million figure. Now that is that they're kind of coming up with this on their own. They would have to negotiate that with all the students, athletes.
That was my next question.
Because if a court says it's 20 million, do the student athletes would form a union or some negotiating organization? Because I know unions are illegal in some places, or if you're going to be a state employee, right? Like,
right.
How are they coming up with the 20?
Great question.
Thank you. That's what they said when
Dan.
I was in fifth
great,
grade. Also,
great question,
excellent
little
question.
Dan. We didn't Wetzel. Get into too deeply in our explainer story, but we mentioned it briefly how they came up with it, which is they took power. It took the average of certain revenue generating streams in a Power Four athletic department. So the main revenue generating streams of any Power Four athletic department are ticket sales, media rights, TV contracts, and donations, right? Those are the three main ones. Donations, from what I understand, were not included in the number. So it was mainly ticket sales, TV rights, sponsorships, maybe things like that. And they came up with an average of what of the Power Four average, you know? So that number is around 20, maybe it depends on how you do the numbers, could be maybe in the low 20s by the end of the negotiations. And so that's how they came up with that number. Now, your second question is, what about some kind of negotiating with the current athletes? Well, this is a class action. So the current athletes are supposed to be represented in the negotiations. And past athletes and current athletes are supposed to be represented in the negotiation. But that doesn't stop potentially other lawsuits from being brought by athletes who think they should earn more, or the number should be potentially higher. And that is why, as we wrote in that in our explainer, that is why Congress, I know, Dan, but Congress is still needed. It needs to be codified by Congress, any kind of settlement or new revenue model. And there's a lot of faith and confidence that that can happen if you bring Congress a settlement, say, we're going to pay the athletes. Here we're going to pay them. Not only that, we back paid them. Please help us and codify and protect this so we can move forward without being sued every day.
Yeah, the skinny bill is what works at that place. They need a very simplified thing. Do all athletes get paid the same? Or is there a differentiating rate for football?
Yeah. And great question. Yeah.
Teacher's pet Wetzel has taken all my questions.
Unbelievable. I was an unbelievable student. Elite.
I bet Mrs. Smith probably went home at night and said to Mr. Smith, that Dan Wetzel, he's such a smart young child, but he doesn't focus very well. He's a bit of a smart aleck.
Judy Smith loved me. She loved me. I'll tell you that right now. No, I don't think she did. But she did. She's a nice woman. Very nice woman. Okay. Shouldn't even joke about her.
Well, little
much
Dan.
Much more decent human being than me, her not prize student. But go ahead.
Teacher little Dan, Dellinger. It is a good question. And let me read a line from my story yesterday. Common sense tells us that athletes participating in a sport that generates the most revenue are likely to earn more of a share of that revenue than those participating in sports that don't generate as much revenue. However, there is a federal law called Title IX, and it requires schools to offer equal opportunity to men and women athletes, and it certainly is heralded as a significant driver in producing a successful United States women's athletic movement, especially on the Olympic stage, because a lot of these young women have come through college pipelines, through sports that were sanctioned by schools specifically to adhere to Title IX. But the big question is, how does Title IX apply to some kind of revenue sharing model? If you're Ohio State and you can share, you hit the cap, say it's 20 million, and you can share 20 million with athletes, do you have to share 10 of the 20 million with women athletes? And that's a big question. I think Charlie Baker, back in January, the NCAA president, he said the terminology, based on the Title IX terminology, it's about equal participation, so specific opportunities, and not equal amounts of compensation. That is something that has been argued against when you speak to Title IX lawyers. And what's really going to have to happen here is the courts are probably going to have to decide. This is not going to stop the settlement if it does happen. It's not going to stop all lawsuits. And one of them that is ongoing actually in Oregon right now is over Title IX. The courts are going to have to eventually decide that. So in the meantime, because courts work slowly, much like the NCAA and Congress, it could be 2, 3, could be 4 years away before we get that answer. In the meantime, what do schools do? They have to probably follow their advice of their legal counsel, but it should be interesting to see what decisions are made when it comes to how much money athletes receive and how you split that revenue.
Okay, I have one more, then I'll let Pat ask some questions. So I was a know-it-all with the hand up. Ohio State has, according to their figures, 1,118 student-athletes, because they have 34, something like that, sports. $20 million for that is $17,889 per athlete. Auburn, not a small operation, actually will have similar amounts of, not as big, quite as big overall athletic department, because they don't have that many things. So they only field 21 teams. They have 500 athletes about. That's $40,000 a pop if you go to the $20 million. That's a pretty good number. 23,000, approximately $22,100 more dollars per year in salary. Maybe not for football stars, but this would seemingly be a massive advantage in non-revenue sports, if or Olympics, whatever we're calling it. Like if you're choosing between Auburn and Ohio State and you are going to run track or, like we said, whatever the sport, and you're going to make 21 grand more somewhere else, you don't really have NIL opportunities. That would seem to be something, because they get really upset about this type of a little bit of money being the big difference. They got upset when USC could offer more in cost of living stipend than Iowa, right? Because, hey, did you know it's a little more expensive in Los Angeles than it is in Iowa City? But they got fired up and opposed that for years because of this. This would seem to be an issue that they would have a lot of issues with. And I wonder whether it alone would lead to the, maybe we don't need to have 1,118 college athletes. We got to drop it down because the ones are not, it probably wouldn't affect football, but the other sports it would.
Yeah.
Pat knows better than this. I don't know if this has been discussed.
No, but yeah. I was thinking very much along the same lines.
You had three college athletes, Pat. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would 21 grand per year more money have influenced their recruitment in any way? Maybe not Brooke, who is going to Stanford, where there's not a lot of, that's a certain, but the other, you had one go to Georgia and one go to Missouri. Would 21 grand, if they could have gone to Purdue or North Carolina, have changed the difference in your family?
It might have. I think it certainly would have provoked a conversation about it. Yeah. You know, that. Now, I will say both of them turned down bigger scholarships elsewhere. So they did turn down more money, basically, to take the ones that they did. That was your money.
Yeah,
that's true.
Not their money.
That's correct.
Yeah, I find that interesting with kids.
They value
that differently. Yeah.
I know. I still somewhat mourn the 86% scholarship to North Carolina that one of my sons turned down, but that's okay. That's going to have to be, that would be a factor. And I do think that schools would look at that and say, is this going to be an adverse competitive situation? And the easy way to change that is, well, let's just eliminate a couple of sports, especially men's Olympic sports, you would think would be the ones that would be on the chopping block there. I think that's definitely part of this. Now, Ross, you probably know, it stands to reason, right, that this is independent of NIL money, right? This does not take the place of NIL money.
That is correct. Let me hit on a few things of why folks may be against a settlement, or why a settlement would be maybe not the best route, some believe. And one is NIL. NIL is separate, and this does not, there's no, you know, concept in the settlement, in the agreement for NIL. NIL is, at least NIL inducements and such, is a separate case brought before attorneys generals in Virginia and Tennessee against the NCAA. So now, however, if a school can buy an athlete's exclusive NIL rights, which this would probably allow, from what I understand, then all of a sudden it does cut out outside NIL or NIL from a collective. And you hear the term in-house NIL, we've talked about a lot. So it would create that. But all athletes might not want their NIL rights exclusively held by their school. And that would mean that at places with so many resources that you can hit the cap of 20 or 22 or 25 or whatever it ends up being, then you could go over the cap by using your collective and by using outside NIL. Now, how many places can hit the cap? I was talking to a coach last night here in Phoenix. I had a number in my head of how many programs could afford to pay, you know, upwards of $20, $25 million. The number I had in my head was vastly different than the one that he said.
What was yours?
Mine was 15 to 20 schools.
15 to 20. Okay. So Pat and I can play like that Price is Right game, high or low.
And his was nowhere
higher.
Near my number.
I say,
you say higher. Easier. Okay.
I'd say double. I'd say 30 to 40.
Yeah, easy. They'll there find you go. Money.
It's exactly what it was. It was 35 to 40. Mm. Yeah.
And I think 10 he was more thinking, will find the way.
Yeah. I think y'all are right. You know, when I think about it, you know, because of the recruiting and the highly competitive nature of all that, as one AD here in Phoenix said to me, we can find the money. We can find the money some way. Whether that's cutting, as Pat said, cutting men's sports, that's probably something that is going to be considered. Reducing salaries, stopping facilities, renovations and building, and just moving. A lot of this is moving the money from the collective, whether that's 3 to 5 to 10 to 15 million dollars. Well, moving those donations under the school umbrella into the school. And so donors would just continue to give to the school. Not only that, they would be able to have write-off. Donations would be written off through the school as well.
That's an interesting dynamic there.
What I think, you know, college athletics is an operation that has operated without operation that operated. It's good. Without any fiscal constraints, real fiscal constraints, it's only gotten bigger. And so the amount of waste and excess in a college athletic department, I didn't look this up before, but I did that. I did a story once I used Michigan as an example, but like, you know, and like, it was like late 2000s, like in the like 2008, they had like, you know, whatever, this many employees, and then they're up 70% more employees, right? We talked about we need a third full-time assistant baseball coach and stuff like that. There is a ton of that, the opulent facilities, the locker rooms, the things. The athletes may get paid, but they are going to lose something. And so we already saw Texas A&M started laying people off. Which is funny because Texas A&M has plenty of money. I don't know whether that was really financially based or they were just new guy came in and did some, used it as an excuse to hack. We're all in the media industry. We're well aware how mass layoffs go.
Yeah. Sometimes. Hate to see it for anybody, but yeah, we know.
We know how it works, and the stated reasons are often not the actual reasons. But if you're an athlete, you may no longer have, you know, a renovation of your facilities the greatest. You might have to have your office your locker room gets a little dated or something like that, or the coaches' offices aren't as nice, or, you know, they've instead of having 15 or 5 mental health professionals there to deal with the athletes, they may only have 3, or nutritionists or whatever it is may get curbed back. So you're going to lose something. You're going to get paid directly, but they have spent all this money so that they didn't have to pay the athletes, and they ran out of things that were reasonable to spend it on. So I think a lot of schools will find 20 million. My guess is this thing goes up, but obviously on the chopping block would be sports, because that's the easiest way to make significant cuts. And there's the kind of the old Winston Churchill line, don't ever waste a good crisis. And I would suspect there are some athletic departments out there that'll just sit there and say, oh, well, we got to settle this house case. Shoop, shoop, you know, men's wrestling gone, you know, whatever. Women's crew gone. Whatever we got to cut, that's going to save us a great deal of money, because it's going to be about protecting football and to a lesser degree basketball and maybe a baseball or hockey, whatever other thing your school might be into.
Well, Dan, go back to your point about recruiting and you're talking about the amount of athletes in a school and then dividing the the revenue sharing by that. We don't really know yet about requirements on, like we talked about Title IX, but requirements on how many athletes, you know, have to be shared with, you know, how revenue has to be shared with. We don't know the particulars around that. And I'm going to assume that every athlete isn't going to necessarily be able to take part, you know, be shared revenue. I think schools are probably, like, if I look at Charlie Baker's model that came out in December, which has a lot of similarities to this, this settlement. I think that only a portion of athletes would have gotten compensation. And this one, and then he kind of, his model, his proposal, let the schools decide which athletes and how many, really, if they, as long as they met the minimum number, which was half of the athletes. So I'm going to assume the settlement is something similar, but we don't know particulars yet. Now, what you're talking about of cutting sports is, and cutting men's sports is probably where a lot of athletic directors will look first when it comes to trying to find additional revenue. You mentioned Texas A&M and eliminating a dozen or more of their high level athletic administrators. I probably saved a few million dollars. Now, at some point, they have to hire some of them back. I think Trev Alberts has to have some kind of executive group committee around him. You know, I think that's a way too, is athletic administration positions. And but we're already seeing, we saw it in the new Missouri athletic director's contract, Laird Veach, where there is a clause in there that would require him to renegotiate his deal in some way, I believe, if there is some kind of sharing revenue with athletes. We're going to see more of that in contracts and even coaches' contracts, I think.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be fascinating just to see what the institutional responses are to coming up with the money. You know, most of them already feel like they are leveraging their donors as much as they can. So, yeah, are you going to try to curb spending? And, you know, Jeffrey Kessler said, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, right? That Kessler's like, you know, do you need to pay your strength coach $1 million? Do you need to pay this person, your AD, $3 million, this and that? You don't, but they're accustomed to it. And the one place most ADs I've talked to say we aren't cutting is football. We are not going to cut corners there. It's going to be everyone else. And I did have another AD say to me, said, hey, we don't really want to cut sports because we don't want the blowback for that. But one thing we could do, especially with men's Olympic sports, is try to go kind of Ivy League model and say, we're just not offering scholarships. We're still going to have coaches. We're going to have teams. We're going to have the facilities. But you're going to pay your way. Yeah, they are really not even club. They'd be varsity still. But they're just not scholarship funded like the Ivy Leagues. And the Ivy League still gets a lot of extremely good athletes. Now, they're also getting an Ivy League education. Whereas, you know,
I would say for most Olympic sports now, because of the amount of money it costs to train to have a child in any kind of competitive youth sports, college athletics, like, it is sort of built on the idea of, you know, I don't know. Okay, you got the keys to the gym from your coach down the high school, and you were always in there, right? Getting up shots or working out in the gym. That isn't how it works anymore. Even in, right? You have a personal coach. You have skill training. You spend $20,000-$30,000 a year traveling around the country. There's not just, hey, dad, can I get some grounders in down at the diamond? You're playing perfect game in Georgia and Arizona. The people that are the athletes that are going in now are middle, upper middle, and wealthy families in a higher, I guarantee you, a higher number than football, basketball, something like that. There's absolutely no way you could be an elite Division I college athlete. Or I won't say no. 90%+ of those people have had their families invest hundreds of thousands of dollars into their training. I've argued this in the past. Is there any discernible change in the makeup of your team if you then say you get to play at our school, but you have to pay? I don't think there is. I think if every single the sport I know better is soccer, every soccer or tennis recruit, there was no scholarships. They're not doing it for the scholarship. They're doing it for the chance to continue the athletic career. And you would still say, I want to go here or here or here. Division III is loaded with student athletes. I have looked, but there are Division III athletic programs, many of them with over 1,000 student athletes. Auburn has 500, right? Auburn. There are 1,000 student athletes at a school that is Division III, a smaller school that may only have a few thousand students. Half the school, 60, 70% of the school is student athletes because they're continuing travel sports. So there are families out there willing to pay full freight to go to a school that really doesn't have the notoriety often, or the academic, at least admissions heft. Certainly there's your University of Chicago's or your Amherst colleges or something. But for the most part, Division III is a lot of small schools in the Midwest and the South and stuff like that, the Northeast, because their daughter wants to keep playing field hockey, which is fine. But they're willing to pay a lot of money to send them to continue that on. So I think if you cut scholarships, not a lot would change in terms of who's good, who's not, and the whole experience. But that's going to be I can say that. I don't know how many ADs are able to say that without getting fired.
Right. No, I mean, it's a very controversial stance, but that could be a way out in this. Now, it could also be, and this will depend on what the emphasis of your schools are, but like if 30 schools that play hockey say we're going to go non-scholarship hockey, but then, you know, BC and Denver University and Michigan, Duluth, no, we're still full scholarship, so the imbalance will be even greater of who's good and who isn't. But that doesn't mean you don't offer the sport. You just save a little more money by offering a sport as a non-scholarship product.
Especially at your Sun Belt, your MAC. You just all right. Get together, yes, and say, wait, you want to come play here? We got, you know, and it'll probably sort itself out. I don't know. If you talk about donations, I'm just going to end this with that. We'll talk more house case, but even my big-brained fifth grade, I mean, let's just say I've had legal analysis here. I have done economics. I did some quick math, and I quoted math. Winston Churchill. You tell me God. How good of a student I was in the fifth grade.
We might need to get Mrs. Smith on as a guest.
An elite academic weapon is what I was doing back then.
A weapon, like Harbaugh called the offensive line draft prospects.
Yes,
weapons.
Very much so. Coach Harbaugh and I, very similar. Similar brains, very powerful. I don't want to bore the as we get into these serious conversations. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to leave everyone behind. That's why I try to step back to my fifth grade self. But even then, God. I'm like young Sheldon. I'm like young Sheldon out here. All right, we'll be back right after this message. You talk about the donations and this very interesting story. Matt Stahl of AL.com, he FOIA'd all the SEC athletic departments for total contributions. Now, this is not to their collectives, but their total contributions from their donors to the athletic department. Now, these were not broken out by football, but you can imagine some of it. But the disparity is enormous. Texas A&M came in first in the SEC, $115.4 million in donations.
Is this for 1 year? Just for a single
fiscal
year?
Fiscal 23, yeah. Now, if you recall, they did $750 million the year Johnny Manziel won the Heisman.
Yeah.
And they rebuilt Kyle. They rebuilt everything down.
Yeah.
So this is, I mean, this is during, I know Jimbo got most of it, but they ain't even winning. They got $115 million. Second place was Texas. 85.9.
Holy cow. That big a gap?
That big a gap. Okay. Significant. Last place, Mississippi State, 21.1. You're talking almost $100 million more dollars that Texas A&M can raise over Mississippi State. Missouri, 28.1. Arkansas, 33.2. Ole Miss, 34.4. South Carolina was 34.6. Kentucky was 38 million even. Auburn, 41.4. Alabama, 48.9. I mean, Texas and Texas A&M are... Their average would double up Alabama, Florida, 49.2. These are not small operations, and they're getting trounced by the Texas schools.
Now we know why you're listing out the reason why Nick Saban 2 years ago, right, went so public,
yeah,
with what Texas A&M was doing with NIL. And Texas A&M is a good example of a school that can not only hit the cap, but would keep around a collective to go over it and pay their athletes more. In a collective, kind of, we don't know right now, but doesn't necessarily fall under Title IX. It's not a school, it's not an educational outfit. So, but that's still to be,
right.
Remains to be seen. But,
they're cutting people
that,
too.
Yeah. You know?
A&M.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Belt tightening. Only got $115 million in here.
Yeah. Now, some of that money, Dan, I wonder if some of that money, because sometimes these things can be a little fuzzy. Like a lot of schools' donations will spike when they're raising money for facilities in a single year. You know, if they're like building a new whatever, then all of a sudden their donations can go, like literally can double if they got some big gift for a facility. So I would love to see like over a span of years what it is.
Why don't you assign that to Matt down there at Hill.com and get a I don't know. Well, I think Texas A&M's,
yeah,
but I'll just do the rest because I know people are wondering just quickly and then you can get on with it. Top six would be, so Florida's LSU 58.8, Oklahoma is in fifth place at 60.7, Tennessee 62.2, and then there's a little Georgia 75.8, and then Texas 85.9 and A&M. So just to discuss the disparity. Now, in terms of percentage, like A&M is using 41% of their entire of total revenue is because I won't even get into that part. Go ahead. Have at that list. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I would like to know, somebody holler when Texas A&M wins something.
It hasn't done much for you.
No.
Pack.
No. I mean, jeez. Hey, you know, they've got some good Olympic sports. They don't win national championships. I'm going to look up the last time Texas A&M won a national championship in anything other than meat judging. I think they're good in that. But
So by the way,
excellent.
Sportico, and the Knight Commission and Sportico both have like all of these numbers. They're always really fun and kind of cool to go through. And like I've just pulled up the donations from last year, and you know, it has all the SEC schools. It also has all the school, it has all the FBS schools. It has A&M, yeah, at 115. Texas is number two at 85. And then Clemson came in last year at number three. At $84 million,
little old Clemson,
Georgia, Tennessee. So four of the top five were from the SEC. Clemson was the outlier there at number three. But just look at the gap between Clemson, number three, pulling in $84 million, and then the 20th program in donations. So from the third program of donations of Clemson at $84 million to the 20th, which is Penn State, at $40 million. You know, which is half. Now, again, the Clemson number could be clouded. They could have been raising money for whatever. But this has actually all the years going back. You can go through at least around 8 to 10 years. And it would be interesting to see, you know, the reported numbers from a full kind of span. But it does give you, it's a great point, Dan. It gives you an idea of the donor bases of these programs and those who could go over the cap, right? Which is, when I saw 15 to 20, it's more like probably 35 to 40. You know, how many schools last year had raised over 25 million in donations? It looks like, according to this list on Sportico, 38 schools. So right around the 40 number that we discussed. Kansas State raised 25 million, and that was the 38th in the country.
All right, let's get to some football, because there were some more spring games. We mentioned Nebraska, some of the others earlier this week that had big spring games. And one of them was, of course, Colorado, Coach Prime. And the revolving door, the subway turnstile that is the Buffaloes roster. And Coach Prime decided to, of course, address a few of the issues here, as always. Two things he had said. He told the Colorado fans that he thinks the Buffaloes can go win a bowl game this year. We're going to get it, he said. Now, I think this would be an absolutely reasonable goal. And you take over the worst major college football program in the country, or worst performing, and 2 years later win the Pop-Tart Bowl, hey, you're doing pretty good. The problem is, he previously set expectations at, did he ever say he'd win a national title? Playoffs, like everything, right? So now it's a little more reasonable, which I think would have helped out. Secondly, he said that he is not planning on leaving Colorado when his sons, Shador, obviously is expected to be a high draft pick next year in the NFL draft, quarterback, and Shiloh, safety, and we don't know his future, conclude their eligibility. His quote, "I don't follow my kids. I pave roads for my kids. I build generational wealth for my kids. I lead my kids. I don't follow my kids. So I do not plan on following my kids to the NFL. I love everything about this part of the country and the fan base that we have here. I just want to really bless you with a tremendously successful team. I really do. That's my heart." Those are the messages Coach Prime wanted to put through to he ain't going anywhere, and they can win a bowl game. And Pat, what do you think?
He also had this great line about enjoying Colorado. He says, "I don't fly fish, but I sometimes do look fly when I fish." He is a bass fisherman.
And he wants to open a snowmobile line. Coach Prime's snowmobile, snow machine, depends where you live, what they called.
Yeah.
So
could
that thing would probably be pretty badass. Like a snowmobiles are badass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
his would be the baddest ass, I would think.
Coach Prime Colorado Buffalo snowmobile.
Yeah, I could see those selling in the high country for sure. He came out and addressed a few of the speculations there that certainly have percolated about his program, because his recruiting strategy, which has just kind of been to pull things together via the portal short term year to year, does not lend itself to long term program building. And so I think it's a natural question to ask, and we've asked it on the pod. Is he just in this for as long as his kids are in it? So we'll see if he backs up what he said there, that he wants to continue to be the coach of the Buffaloes for a long time. Getting to a bowl game would be a very good accomplishment. They could have gotten there last year. They gave away a couple of games, ended up 4-8. They could have gotten to 6-6. They didn't. So next step would be bowl game. Now that is, you know, he's also kind of painted himself as the ultimate disruptor of the status quo, and he was going to maybe outsmart everybody, and the paradigm shift would be so dramatic and so fast that they would be competing for national championships in short order. They're not on that flight plan right now. We will see if they can get there. But as with everything with Coach Prime, you know, there are huge reactions, overreactions, people that love him, people that hate him, and are taking everything as either a sign of the apocalypse or a sign that he is being oppressed by unfair critics. And I do think the criticism that was out there of the attendance for the spring game was ridiculous. It was down from 47,000 to 28,000. 28,000 still by far the second highest spring attendance Colorado's ever had. People never went to the spring game. Right. Yeah, these were not free tickets. These were tickets you had to buy. So the idea that that this is some
and it
sort
rained
of,
and all that, yeah.
Just, yeah. Yeah. Of course, I mean it snowed for his first game too.
Yeah.
But you know, I thought people again are overreacting to something that might not be indicative of much of anything.
Coach Prime has been on fire this morning on Twitter. Yes. You guys should go check that out. He has added and tweeted that it looks like players, some of them criticizing his sons, I think, in their play. So it's been interesting. He tweeted this morning. He's basically got all the time in the world, you know, to go back and forth with people on Twitter, and boy, he's going back. So it's been interesting to follow. Speak of the devil there, as we're talking about him, he's firing off goodness. Tweets to, yeah. Have
yeah,
you found them, Pat?
Now. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I have. Yeah. This is,
yeah.
This is interesting.
He's going back and forth. So I think it's probably all triggered from, and I haven't read it yet, but the Max Olson piece at The Athletic kind of documented all the transfers that he pushed out last year and where they are, and had some interesting quotes in there, you know, some people might say some damning quotes about Deion Sanders and how he handled some of the exodus. But man, yeah, he's on fire today on the Twitter machine.
Yeah. They're definitely going after Jaheim Ward, who is at Austin Peay. they're after him. I don't know why. All right, this is it. There, nothing like fight. That's good. I don't have time to visit a high school to recruit, but I definitely have time to fight people on Twitter. Yeah. Nothing like getting lit up by Coach Prime.
fighting with somebody about who's criticizing his son. Oh boy.
Little dispute here. Cormani McClain, of course, the great top five recruit they signed in the class of 2023, never worked out at Colorado. He left. He's trying to get people. He's not committed, as far as I know. 24/7 was reporting that there's some apprehension. Some schools are not pursuing him. McClain said last week, some people just got to take a step back from some things. Certain people, you know, I feel like I don't want to play for clicks. I actually want to be involved with a great leading program that's going to develop players. I'm just ready to bring the old version of me out, change the narrative everyone's thinking on my name, be part of a real and great program that's going to impact me, so on. So he's looking for a school. Doesn't obviously mention Coach Prime there, but I think we can read through that. Not mentioning, and this was not in response to Cormani McClain, but Shador, after the thing, he said of all the people leaving the portal, he said, it's definitely a lot of highs and lows. But I feel like we got all the negative energy out of the building. So I don't know. It is a soap opera. Don't take a shot at Shador though. Papa Bear will come after you. Apparently.
That's right. On Twitter.
Yep. Good job. Keep it up, Prime. Keep it up. One guy who left, Dylan Edwards, who was, star of their TCU game right off the bat. He was a big recruit that Prime got. He flipped from Notre Dame. He was originally, I think, committed to K-State and then went to Notre Dame. And then before he enrolled, he flipped his recruitment and signed with Colorado. And it was really a kind of thing that made a lot of the hype on Colorado last year to be a big thing. It was like, man, Prime is just walking in and flipping recruits. Give him some time to work recruiting, and he's going to get a bunch of them. I don't know when the last time Colorado took a Notre Dame running back, let alone one who was pretty good. behind perhaps the worst offensive line in major college football. He had 321 yards. Also caught 36 passes for 300. Very dynamic player. He left in somewhat of a surprise. Now, they brought in other guys and committed to Kansas State. Now, he is originally from Derby, Kansas, just outside of Wichita. And regardless of what happened or didn't happen at Colorado State, this is a next step in what I am super intrigued about this Kansas State team next year. Because Dylan Edwards was just a true freshman, so he's got some years. They already have DJ Giddens, who rushed for 1,226 yards and 10 TDs and also caught a ton of passes out of the backfield. And he'll be the number one carrier. Now you're adding the depth. He's from Wichita. Avery Johnson, their quarterback, played tremendous in the Pop-Tart Bowl, and that's where legends are made. If you can do it in the big stage of the Pop-Tart Bowl, I don't think a regular season would matter. He was a true freshman from the Wichita area, and I think he's really promising and exciting. Threw two TDs, ran for 71 yards. K-State, Chris Klieman, they won 8, 10, and 9 games the last couple of years, including aforementioned Pop-Tart victory. Pat, Wildcats have always kind of punched above their weight or often punched above. This is like a dynamic team.
Sure is. And it's funny. I mean, talk about a coach who's probably the anti-Dion. It would be Chris Klieman. Like, as understated, just kind of a low-key dude who shows up and does the job. And he's put together a good team here. As you mentioned, they've been very good the last 3 years. They've been competitive. They won a Big 12 championship. And now, yeah, there's a lot that they're putting, I think, together here that could make them Big 12 favorites, possibly. I'd say them or Utah probably going into this next season. And one thing, now Avery Johnson, we'll see if he can throw. Got to be able to throw the ball some. And their offense has at times gotten a little bit one-dimensional, regardless of who was the quarterback. But if they can stay diversified enough and be able to throw, then they're going to score points, and he's always going to have a solid defense. And I think K-State's a program on the rise that could be perfect for a 12-team playoff. Look out. And what if they host a playoff game in Manhattan, Kansas? Mm. Wow.
Manhattan, Kansas playoff game in mid-December. All right.
Yeah. Get your hotel rooms in Aggieville now.
Dream come true. Little Apple. Anyway, they lost Will Howard to Ohio State, but I don't think this is all they got. So I'm excited for this K-State upcoming season. All right. It's the Kentucky Derby this weekend. Pat's very excited, of course. Louisville gets going. Nobody mixes a high-level horse racing coverage with at least temporary semi-functional alcoholism like Pat over the next 5 days. It's the real Triple Crown winner is how he can handle the writing, the reporting, and then the late-night drinking at Kern's and all your other little bars there.
I've got a posse going to Kern's Thursday night.
Yeah,
look out.
Yeah.
And yeah, let's just say, too, that having the draw on Saturday night, opening night of racing, also lent itself to a very early start to Derby revelry. So we've already been going.
Great performances in human history is every year Pat at the Derby. Somehow at the end of this debauchery, he cranks out a hell of a column on these horses. So, but it's also time for Pat to get a little cranky because he doesn't like certain parts of the Derby, particularly horse names. Now, we had a very famous segment where Pat went through and detailed the worst names for horses in the history of the Kentucky Derby. How many years they've done the Derby? Like 160 or something?
This would be the 150th this year, the longest continuous sporting event in America.
I knew that, 150. Yeah. 150 years of crazy horse names. Pat, we have new members of your top 10 worst named horses. I mean, this is amazing. Pat will take time to denigrate, to rip to shreds, to humiliate some horse that died 143 years ago.
Correct.
Too soon.
Still outraged about, and his poor horse hasn't done anything since heading to the glue factory like 143 years ago, but because it had a name that Pat finds displeasure with, he's going to mock him on this globally produced podcast.
Damn
distributed.
Right. It still goes back to Wool Sandals, 1907, worst name ever in Derby history.
Wool Sandals, that's your worst name? Can you do the
worst
top 10?
Worst of all time.
Do it backwards like Letterman used to or something.
Well, I wrote it 3 years ago, the top 20, the 20 worst. And I can run through them quickly.
Okay.
Alphabetical order.
Do you have new entries or not?
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah. Okay. I got two from the new ones.
Do 20 down and just tell us which one were the new ones.
All right, here we go. So here in alphabetical order. Here,
and what makes a bad name, Pat? What makes a bad name?
I'll go through this a little bit as we go. That's What I'm Talking About. 2003. The run-on mashup names are terrible. So that one, no.
That's What I'm Talking About.
That's what I'm talking about. All one
talking
word.
About.
That's what I'm talking about.
That's not going to, that is aging bad. In 150 years, there'll be a new Pat Forty screaming about that one.
Yes, there should be.
300 years.
Big truck. No, don't name your animals after vehicles. Black Servant in 1921 for very obvious reasons was a very bad choice.
A little bit dicey there. Yeah.
Can't believe that ever was allowed even in 1921. Daddy Knows Best, N-O-S-E. No puns that bad.
I kind of like that one.
What year was that?
I kind of like that.
That was 2012.
Oh, terrible.
Dit, 1940. Gatch,
what?
1975.
Wait,
slow down,
Pat. Hold on. What? Dit? Like D-I-T? D-I-T?
Why? What does that mean? Dit.
Does not roll off the tongue.
Dit.
I never got a reason for why that was the name. It was 1940. I think pretty much everybody associated with the horse is gone. Gatch, same thing. You cannot name your horse Dit or Gatch. Green Alligator, no. Don't name them after reptiles. Jacqueline Klugman, which was kind of named after Jack Klugman, but is Jacqueline instead? No. Killer Diller, no. Lil E.T., who actually won in 1992. Is the only Derby winner whose name could be mistaken for a dog track greyhound.
Lost Cause. Wait, what? Go back. What's the name of the one that won?
Lil E.T. L-I-L, capital E, period, T-T-E-E.
Like Wile E. Coyote? It's like W-I-L and then the E. Yeah.
Yeah. I would have preferred Wile E. Coyote to Lil E.T.
Wile E. Coyote's a badass, yeah.
Yeah. Lost Cause, that's pretty much a defeatist name to begin with.
Has anyone ever been hit by more falling anvils than Wile E. Coyote?
Who knew there were so many anvils out there ready to fall?
Yes, just falling on Wile E., just hitting them.
Sometimes like out in the middle of the desert or something.
Yeah,
you know?
Just bang.
From the sky. Quasimodo, obvious reasons. Chocolate One, that's a bad mashup of parent names. Shut Up, 1944. Rude.
I thought you'd like that
Rude.
One.
I kind of like that one.
Yeah, I kind of. After this podcast, I'm usually.
I'm on board.
Yeah. Top
Snuzzle.
10 favorite.
Oh, God. Hmm. And here was the one that actually spawned the list in 2021. Soup and Sandwich.
Oh, that one fired you up.
Yeah.
Can't be a lunch order. You can't do a lunch order as your name.
You cannot do a lunch order. No.
Didn't that one also do something like nacho cheese or something like ham and cheese? Wasn't there... Didn't that?
Well, there were multiple soup entries from this. Like the owner of those Campbell Soup Air named a bunch of her horses with soup in their name.
Oh, God.
So, not good. The Clown, 1923, ran 18th, ran like Bozo. TV commercial, which was 1968. If it had been like 1954 when TV was new, okay, but this was like late 60s. Watermelon, 1914.
Doesn't,
you can't
does
name
not
your horse after
speed.
A fruit with no legs? No. And then Wool Sandals. So,
Wool Sandals,
but this year's, this
what is
year's
a wool
entries,
sandal?
I don't know, but it sounds itchy and uncomfortable and weird. So,
as someone who will, in the middle of February, if I got to take out the trash or something, I'll throw my sandals on just because it's out there quick. I would not have wool sandals.
No,
even
you
here
would,
in Detroit.
Would you?
No.
Especially, you might have to walk through slush and you get wool wet, and that's really bad. So, so this year, the two worst names are Japanese horse T.O. Password. I don't know what the T is. I don't know what the O is. And Password, like if the horse wins in 6 weeks, do they have to change the name?
What in the world?
Everybody hates passwords.
I know. Every 6 weeks, you got to update the horse's name.
If you're going to be T.O. Password, then you have to include a capital, a number, and one of them little symbols.
Yeah. That's right.
You can't just be Password. No. You got a Password, !! or something like that.
That's right. It should be a T $O.
Yes.
Yeah.
I agree. Right. Crap name. Yeah.
Terrible.
Hope you come in last.
I hope it. Well, you know what?
Second
excellent
to last.
Possibility. Excellent possibility for T.O. Password. I mean, like, going to bolt out there like crazy, going to be way too fast, way too soon, and will die like a dog, much like Soup and Sandwich did 3 years ago.
Vicious.
And then Grand Mo the First. No. No. And it's dad is Uncle Mo, who was turned out to be a great sire, but Grand Mo, no. And this, like, the first part, like, no.
So is this like grandma, or is it?
Kinda, I don't know.
Is it one word? Is Grand Mo one word or two words?
No, it's Grand, then M-O, Mo, and then the first.
Not surprised that this is the first time someone wanted to name their horse Grand Mo.
Who's the favorite?
The favorite is Fierceness. I like the name. I like the horse. I think the horse is going to win.
Oh, Pat's picks right there.
There you go.
Fierceness. Grand Mo, the first.
Yep. So Grand Mo out. What's his face? T.O. Password definitely out. I think we're looking at Fierceness and Sierra Leone, who are the two favorites, but they're the two favorites for a reason.
These horse owners and their bad names drive Pat to drink.
They do.
He gets very angry at these bad names.
Check in with me later tonight. There will be drinking.
All right. Well, that's our show. We'll let Pat get to what he needs to get to. Enjoy Derby weekend. Cinco de Mayo. Got all sorts of stuff going on. We'll be back next week with more college football and general college sports talk, plus people's courts and stupid things like horse names. Continue to subscribe. Share us on social media. Please tell your friends to listen. We need them. And everyone have a great weekend. Talk to you later.